I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today is Christina Aiotis, a security industry expert with extensive global business experience as both corporate counsel and as a business leader, who assists with cyber strategy, cyber risk management, incident breach response, information governance, and more. You can find Christina on LinkedIn and follow her on Twitter at Christina Aiotis. Welcome, Tina. So great to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be here.
So, Tina, to start, I saw that you got your JD at William & Mary Law School. So take us through your career and how you got into cybersecurity, working for the likes of Deloitte and CSC.
Sure. So to the extent back then in law school, I don't think there really was even a field per se of cybersecurity. It was probably more security writ large. But a very curvy path. You could see that on my LinkedIn. I actually started out before law school working in a law firm in litigation, asbestos and mass tort litigation. So that had some aspect of information management and governance to it. And then through a variety of paths and decisions, ended up back in the late 90s in New York City in the professional services arena with first Ernst & Young and then Deloitte in deploying their global technology capabilities. And I think, and that's certainly where I got my privacy start. And I think it was implicit that there was gonna be some level of security. So to the extent that that was my real start in the field and thinking about making sure that certain data types were protected, and then ultimately moved to the Metro DC area and worked for some government contractors inside the Beltway, and drilled down a little bit more and focused on the security side and integrating the security side into the bigger picture. So it's mostly a career of professional services, but on a global basis.
Okay, great. And you founded and co-chaired the first ever continuing legal education program at Georgetown University Law Center, focused on educating lawyers on cyber and an inclusive environment with CISOs, CIOs, board directors, and relevant government colleagues. How did your career and experience lead to you founding and co-chairing this program?
You know, to the extent that when I was deputy general counsel at CSC, I originally focused on e-discovery and privacy. And then as things evolved in the area of information governance, which was about bringing other areas together in an integrated way, security was added to that. And I had a fabulous experience with my internal client, who was the global CIO who owned the security posture at the time, and worked very collaboratively with the CIO, the CISO, who actually was based in London, the security center folks in Australia, and a lot of our colleagues, 40,000 of them at the time, in India, along with the lawyers in the various offices, particularly the lawyers in Germany from a privacy perspective. So having that collaborative context, at least within the organization, and then I spent a lot of time also understanding what was happening outside the organization from a regulatory perspective to be more proactive rather than reactive. It was a context that I thought worked because addressing cyber risk really is a team sport. So having been a volunteer lecturer in Georgetown CLE's Corporate Counsel Institute and Advanced eDiscovery Institute, I liked their business model, which was not a pay to play, but pulling together an advisory board of experts, putting a program together, and then they, which is their for-profit part of Georgetown, they went and then got the sponsors. So I brought a proposal to the head of the Georgetown CLE at the time to start their very first cybersecurity program that would include non-lawyers, which I think was a stretch, but it turned out to be a smashing success. And I'm happy to say that pretty much every law school now does cybersecurity law in the context of bringing in all the other relevant constituencies.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you also had a role as an adjunct faculty member in the Department of Computer Science at George Washington University prior to your time at Georgetown. So did that experience contribute to your desire to found this program as well?
They were two separate things. But I will say that that was a really great opportunity. I had, when I was working for Booz Allen, joined the Northern Virginia Technology Council Security Committee, mostly because I didn't know a lot about security. It was one of those instances where I resisted the temptation not to go places where I was uncomfortable, and ended up having some good relationships with folks in the field, particularly Randy Sabet, who is now over at Cooley, one of the major law firms, but he really is a leader in the field. He started out as a crypto engineer at NSA, and then, as he jokes, went over to the darker side and went to law school. But he had taught that class, and he recommended me to teach. It was a information policy class in a master's program. And I think what I was able to do was to bring experts in and to continuously evolve it. And certainly that experience informed my decision to go with Georgetown and to bring the folks who were preeminent in their field together to be part of an education process. So I guess the adjunct position was the testing ground for a different type of education, which was really more practical, with taking theories, but really having real life people who do things be a part of the conversation. Because as you probably know, there's sometimes a disconnect between policy and what someone says should happen,
right,
and the way the real world works.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of how the real world works, what are some of the top cybersecurity issues folks are seeking your counsel on right now as we look toward the closing of Q1 2021 and in light of recent cyber attacks?
Yeah, you know, I did for many years do some independent consulting. I'm actually in a full-time search for another executive or a deputy general counsel position. But in the meantime, I've been helping some smaller entities and nonprofits in terms of programming. I just on Wednesday evening helped facilitate as an advisor a cybersecurity scenario exercise with the Pacific Forum, with some colleagues, both out of Hawaii and Singapore. And the big picture issues that we talked about really are the ones that everyone's concerned about in terms of supply chain and data flows, and some of the challenges in a global environment of countries taking a more paternalistic view and data localization and things like that. So I'm very excited to have opportunities to pull together my background in cybersecurity, privacy, internet governance, and some of the things that, and privacy in particular, with respect to global data flows and ownership and how that's going to play out in this new world where everything is online and everybody wants to get access and exploit data. So I think the programming that you see coming out of a lot of the think tanks reflects what these next issues that we need to address really need to be.
Right. And speaking of your experience, you know, in light of SolarWinds and everything that's been happening, do you think that kind of put in a position now as a nation that we're going to have to finally upgrade our government cybersecurity? That's just been such an issue for so many years.
It is. And you know, as someone who has had some context, having been inside the Beltway, inside the bubble, I think it's a complex issue. And I remember a couple of years back, I did a program with Ron Ross from NIST, who's just a hero in the security world, having put together the original frameworks that pretty much everybody works from. And a colleague at GAO and I jokingly said during that particular program, if only people would listen to NIST and GAO about what needs to be done. So, you know, year after year, agency after agency gets audited and a report is done with recommendations, do this, do this, do this, but nobody does them. Mm. And I think, but I do think that there's definitely movement in Congress to finally, even today, you could look at the Washington Post, even some things I pushed out on Twitter and LinkedIn this morning, talk about hold it Congress, obviously, who is responsible for allocating funds. I think Congress is saying, look, we're going to need to have more accountability. We can't be spending hundreds of millions of dollars with all these contractors without getting better assurance of cybersecurity within the services and products that they provide. Now, the wrinkle is, both for the public sector and the private sector, is that right now our liability schemes don't envision, in the same way that we have products liability, at least in the United States, any accountability for software. So, I mean, that's purposeful, obviously. There's a huge lobby that ensures that that happens. But, you know, to the extent that there seems to be an acceptance that software vulnerabilities will happen, and there's some agreement about how they'll be disclosed and remediated, but right now nobody's really on the hook. Mm. So you know, to the extent that you have these vendors and they don't really care that much about security, except for selling purposes, until something bad happens, and you know, to the extent that one of the vendors at issue didn't even have a formal security program led by a CISO, again, because there was no requirement to have it. So, and you know, and look where it led. And you know, I must applaud the colleagues over at the New York Department of Financial Services, who years ago realized, at least from the perspective of the financial services sector, which is the lifeblood of New York City and New York State, that you have to have these minimum requirements in place. And believe it or not, they came mostly from the NIST requirements or the ISO requirements. None of it was rocket science, but it was pushed. And I think we have financial services entities that are much better prepared, not just because they have more money, but much better prepared because they have requirements than parts of the government. And I think I hope there's going to be a reckoning so that folks can feel more confident that we're going to have a more secure environment. We can't go on this way every so many days, another huge data breach. You know, it's unsustainable.
Right. Absolutely. And in addition to that level of activity, we're also seeing, especially during COVID-19, increases in phishing attacks, ransomware, and social media phishing. And I read a recent blog post by another industry expert, Rob Kanaki, where he shared that he received a direct message from a fake account that was pretending to be you on Twitter. And your handle is at Christina Iotis, but this one was at Christina Iot 1. And he flagged it. But you then had subsequently shared that you'd been looking to attain a blue check mark so you'd have a verified account to avoid this type of identity theft, you know, confusion, what have you. But of course, naturally, you aren't the only one this is happening to. We had the Twitter hack this past summer in July of 2020. But how has this impacted you and what are your thoughts?
Well, I consider myself very lucky because I was not through that a real victim of identity theft. But identity and access management's been one of my issues for 15 years in terms of managing information. And it's funny, years ago when the blue check mark came out, I wanted one just because I wanted to make sure. And I applied, there was an application process and I got denied. I guess I wasn't important enough or famous enough. And that was fine. And I do remember getting that direct message from Rob, you know, who had been on the National Security Council and has been through his work at Harvard and the Council on Foreign Relations and other places, a real thought leader in the space. And I remember him sending me this, and I got irritated. I was like, I can't believe someone's pretending to be me. I said, what app is that? Because I literally thought it was a new app.
Oh.
Like, I'm not on Clubhouse. I'm not on Parler.
Yeah.
Even though I struggle with whether I should be, just to know how they work. But, you know, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook right now is the extent of my involvement. But I remember he's like, no, this is from Twitter.
Wow.
So that's why I tweeted out when he had wrote the CFR blog piece, which I had no idea about. And I regularly, I've been reading for years all of their stuff. They do excellent work. Adam Siegel, who heads up the program here in New York, they've got a tracker. You know, I've promoted them around the world. When I saw my name, I was really surprised. But the more important point is really about having a way to verify identity. Mm. And that's so crucial in e-commerce. And there are folks that have been literally dealing with this issue for a decade and a half. It's not a new thing, but it is important for people. And, you know, I regularly Google my own daughter, mm-hmm. Who's in graduate school and have since she was a kid, you know, wanting to, you know, typical Tiger Mom stuff to make sure protect her brand. I know every single thing that's said about her, but the point is important. You want to make sure that for yourself and for your family, that they're not being exploited, that they're so, you know, and it's a little bit harder with the social security numbers, but you know, there's just so much horrible fraud, and identity theft. And it's so debilitating. You know, you don't really get compensated. You might not be, at least from a credit card perspective, held responsible for charges, but nobody compensates you for your time and irritation.
Yeah, and, sure.
And the 500 hours you spend trying to fix credit ratings and, you know, the like. So while I didn't necessarily, and I never found out exactly who did it, But the point is really important that we have to come up with a better way to assure validation of identities. And I think for a variety of reasons, right? I mean, certainly sometimes it's easy to figure out if someone's fake, and I get the invitations constantly for the fake profiles, both on hilariously on Facebook.
Yeah.
They usually have some senior retired military. So it's hilarious. And my male colleagues, of course, get the young females.
Yes.
it's just hilarious because we sometimes share them. But it's really an important, a very important, you know, I mean, obviously the Chinese have been very successful in fooling people and getting them to share information unwittingly in some instances. But it is the whole identity issue is an important one for confidence. We can't have systems if we're not confident that we're either sharing or even giving money over to, you know, and that's the worst part in the business email compromise. And the FBI has done a lot of good work on educating and reporting on this, but you know, it's hugely important for organizations to have processes in place to validate the identity of folks, especially the ones who were asking for money transfers.
Right.
I mean, even law firms, and you know, it's a huge education gap that we have, and a process gap too, because I think part of it has to be multiple ways to validate, and multi-factor authentication has helped a lot. But you know, maybe there's even more work that needs to be done, so that we can have the confidence that we need to know that we're talking to the people that we think we're talking to.
Right, right, absolutely agreed. And as far as us as individuals, what more can folks do, if anything, to help reduce these types of, I don't know, attacks on themselves, on their accounts, but then on others?
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, multi-factor authentication, hugely important, makes so much difference, and organizations need to incorporate that. I mean, fundamentally, the SolarWinds hack was found through the fact that in one of the organizations, they noticed that someone had been given access to something that just didn't seem right.
Mm.
That was the right, you know, so every account you have, and every big account you have, you should have multi-factor authentication activated. I mean, it should be the default requirement. You know, don't share passwords. You know, in some instances, people are lazy, and they, you know, it's one of the things where, you know, even especially young people, I feel like they sometimes think it's okay to share their passwords to Hulu or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, you know, one could lead, getting in and access to one thing could lead to another. And,
right.
You know, to the extent that some of the basic hygiene stuff, and, you know, if there's one thing I'd like to leave this audience with, is that basic cyber hygiene and those good habits literally have to start pre-K.
Yeah.
And you know, some countries are doing a better job than others in terms of incorporating safety into the curriculum. You know, Australia's done, and I spent a little bit of time in 2019, a couple of months in Australia, and they have an e-safety commissioner, Julie Immon Grant, just happens to be American, but she's fabulous. And the Australians, you know, admittedly a smaller country than the US, but they've taken the approach of safety, and they have really focused on vulnerable communities, children, the elderly, women who are harassed and victimized, and come out with strategies. I mean, we could learn a lot from what they're doing there in terms of educating, putting the right actual security on activities that people do, and just the awareness.
Fantastic. And to, I guess, pivot topics. Tina, you were featured in the book Women Know Cyber, 100 Fascinating Females Fighting Cybercrime, which was published by Cybersecurity Ventures. And I'd like to hear from you, what does being a woman in cyber mean to you?
You know, I've been very conflicted about the whole bifurcation or the separating out. I've been involved with Women in Technology, with the Hellenic American Women's Council, mm-hmm. with women, I mean, lots of groups, and have been blessed with lots of relationships and occasions to do good work. But I really wish we could get to the point where it was just professionals in cyber,
yeah.
and not women in cyber, that we would recognize not for our gender, but for our expertise, and be respected that way. So again, been involved in all of these groups, continue to be involved in these groups, accept that there is still incredible sexism that needs to be addressed in the field, but And that we continue to need to promote and to mentor and sponsor younger people coming up because we haven't changed the actual infrastructure in society to make it so that people are only judged on the merits.
Right.
And that the system is enabling folks to progress in a way that is fair, you know. So, we still have to have people creating foundations on pay equity. look at pay equity Twitter feed from the foundation that Katie Masura set up. And the particular program at Penn State Law that she set up to focus on that. And, you know, she's one of the leaders in cybersecurity, but, has a story that shows that women haven't necessarily been evaluated on par with men. And so we still need these efforts, but I wish we could get to the point where we didn't.
Right. That makes sense. And I guess as a person in cyber, what was a challenging moment in your career that you overcame and how did you overcome it?
You know, I don't know that there's one particular thing, although I've had plenty of challenging things, but what I will say is that it was challenging in both some employment situations and some volunteer situations to be the only woman in the room mm-hmm. of senior leaders. But I focused substantively on what the issues were. And I think by not focusing on the fact that I was so different from everyone else and by making sure that I was heard and heard in a way that that was acceptable to everyone in the room, I was able to be a part of the team and be perceived as a valued part of the team. So I think I look for the times when we don't have it such that there's only a one in the room, that it's more evenly distributed. And,
right.
and you know, we're working on that. And that will trickle down to cybersecurity when it's also a part of the general business environment and the general public sector environment. And like I said, I've been involved in a lot of these women's groups and it really is about equity and leadership, getting women on boards, on paid corporate boards, getting more women as leaders in governments, and so that it becomes normal in a cybersecurity company or the cybersecurity or the security department of large corporations to see at least half of the staff and the leadership, more importantly, the leadership, be women.
And having been the only woman in many rooms and having that experience and the experience of a great career, what advice would you give to others, women, underrepresented groups, minorities, et cetera, who are looking to build a career in cybersecurity, the tech industry, and I guess even law, if that's something you'd want to talk about as well?
Yeah, I mean, and I do a lot of mentoring, and it was a joke when my daughter was in high school in Falls Church, Virginia. Every time I went to Marshall High School, like, oh my God, there's Andriana's mom. She's going to talk to everybody about getting into cybersecurity. standing outside the orchestra concert hall. But it was true. It is a good field. Back then, people didn't realize how important it was going to be. But, you know, I think more than anything, the message is get engaged, get involved, join professional associations, go places where you know no one and don't know an area very well. Make sure you diversify your community because it's usually in those unexpected places that you learn things. I think we sometimes focus too much in some instances on STEM. Mm-hmm. We need to do STEAM, which adds the A in the arts,
right,
and the creative part. And I think to the extent that volunteer for things, I mean, don't overextend and volunteer too much because you could get sucked into that volunteer industrial complex. But especially when you're younger, volunteer in places to organize events where you can meet people and then connect with them and stay connected with them so that they can be part of your network and your community. I think that's hugely important. I think a lot of folks don't realize that people need to know you over a period of time before they're going to recommend you for things. Or, you know, you need to be a part of a greater community. And it takes work. You have to want to build your brand. You have to, and it takes some level of sponsorship too. So sometimes you have to ask people for help. If you're interested in a particular thing or you want to learn more, say, I want to learn more. Can you introduce me to so-and-so? And hopefully, and in my experience, usually someone says, okay, sure.
Right. Yeah, you don't get what you don't ask for. So that's,
yeah,
it goes a long way for sure. Well, this has been great. And that's great advice. That's new. I've asked a lot of different women in cyber that same question. And that's a great one. So I'm really appreciative of you coming onto the show, Tina. And it was just such a joy speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Christina Aotis, a cybersecurity industry expert with extensive global business experience as both corporate counsel and as a business leader. You can find Christina on LinkedIn, and you can also follow her on Twitter at Christina Aotis. And you can listen to all of our podcast episodes at cybercrime.radio.